This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I have seen the photographs, and I'm very, very excited to meet Devin, because when I saw the pictures, I could not believe what an extraordinary capacity for composition and the rendition, not just of images, but of ideas about a community and a place. And I do love the title, The Beautiful Ghetto, because as we were discussing a little bit before we started, the word ghetto, in fact, is, if I should use the awful term, not accepted in some circles as politically correct anymore. And I lament that in a sense, because I think the word ghetto, as Mitch himself has intimated by the description of his own book, is a word with a history, and a very, very important history. But it is true that in some circles it brings to mind some negative connotations. And the idea of counterposing beautiful with ghetto is my idea of how West Baltimore should be represented. In that, to the eyes of the observer, the uneducated external gazer, this is a place of danger, and it's a place of destitution. But for the people who live there and the people who bother to establish relationships, it is a place also of tremendous resilience, tremendous creativity. Great art comes from those environments, and Devin, I think, illustrates that point. It's also a place of struggle, and a beautiful struggle. So I want to draw attention to the beautiful cover of my book, only to remark that it was produced by one of my former undergraduate students, Andy Chen. I always give him credit, because he took this image right out of my mind. We never consulted. He just this is a book that took a long time to produce. And so he read parts of this book when he was a freshman at Princeton University. He graduated in 2009. That will give you a sense of the time thing. But I do want to draw attention to this, also for Devin, because I do love the profile of this young man, and I love the way in which Andy actually used very large font with the word hero smack. The word, the title has been in my mind for a very, very long time, but the idea that the word hero says exactly what I want to convey in this book and the ethnographic chapters, and that these are all heroes, young and old, welfare mothers with the attitude, children in the streets, youngsters lost in perennial drama, riffing and bantering, all with their own internal poetry, their music, and their capacity to create art out of difficulty. Now, very briefly, and mostly for Devin as well, this is a book which is a big book, and it is anchored and organized around seven biographies, which are ethnographic renditions of lives of people, some of which take us to the beginning of the 20th century. But what I want to emphasize is that in my imagination, those lives had to be the central part of the book, in that we do not have biographies of people living in impoverished American cities. In fact, we don't have biographies of poor people, period, full stop. And as you may imagine, the act of biography is really about assigning value to particular lives. And so it seems to me to be a very important political step to take to recognize the value and the unique character of lives of people who are not celebrities. I always joke with my students that, with all due respect, Kim Kardashian has a biography, which is okay. I'm not disputing that. But people like the ones that I write about are not given that kind of respect or that kind of place in our imagination. And so that kind of effort, I think, is a political effort of restoring value to lives that in our society tend to be devalued. And in that sense, it's also in correspondence with the ideas of the Black Lives Matter movement. The central point about the state, which I just checked with Devin Allen, and he tells me that I'm on the right track, thank you, Devin, is that poverty in American cities is much more than material deprivation. Material deprivation is part of it, but in my estimation, what makes American inner city poverty unique and particularly horrifying is government intrusion, state intrusion. Or to put it very, very briefly, in other parts of the world, poverty exists, but states, bureaucracies, do not have the human resources or material resources to constantly be interfering with the lives of impoverished people. What we have in places like West Baltimore is a whole series of institutions. I call them liminal institutions, and I won't bore you with the detail. These are institutions which appear to be like other organizations, but which in fact have policies that are mostly about supervision, containment, and punishment. So that even those organizations that are explicitly intended to provide services actually do so through a punitive series of practices. And particularly important to me is Child Protective Services, which I think is an institution which has not been sufficiently scrutinized and which, in my estimation, and this I don't have a lot of time here, but which is very much about casting mothers and families as potentially damaging to children, and with a very, very heavy hand, often interfering with the authority of parents. This should be a controversial statement, because these are organizations that are supposed to be in place to help people. I personally find the idea of helping people somewhat paternalistic and condescending, because the assumption is that people who are living in places like West Baltimore need that kind of a condescending attitude, as they are perceived as broken, unable to handle their lives, and so on and so forth. So I have a big beef with that. And so the claim of the book is that these are institutions that deal with American citizens who are citizens more in a nominal than an actual sense, that these are institutions that really complicate the character of poverty in those environments. And just two more very quick things. One of them is that when you look at government as a whole, one of the marks of being middle class, educated, affluent, in other words, mainstream citizen or American, is to be free of government intervention. Sure, we pay taxes, and in fact, we suffer when we do that. But in general, we expect to be left alone by government. In other words, mainstream government institutions deal with individuals as citizens or consumers. You go get the driver's license, a birth certificate, a voter ID card, etc., etc., etc. It's either about financial transactions or about your political participation as citizens. When you look at schools in inner city areas, when you look at halfway houses, at rehabilitative centers, counseling centers, naturally, all the large police apparatus, the justice system, and child protective services, these are institutions which do not deal with Americans as citizens or consumers. They deal with them as potential burdens on the society, and through practices that even require special forms of certification, urine, in order to be able to obtain certain transfer payments, and so on and so forth. In other words, the emphasis is on excessive surveillance, containment, and punishment. It's not the social workers, it's not the teachers, it's not even the police officers, because they are beholden to some of these structural constraints, these practices, these guidelines, these policies that make it almost impossible to interact with people in any kind of empathetic and humane or human way. I feel very strongly then, and that's the argument of the book, take it or leave it, I feel very strongly that what I try to do in some of those portions of the book, which is to capture the beauty and the complexity of existence across whole lives, because yes, for better or worse, I was able to do this research for the better part of a decade. And I was very deeply involved with some of the families that constitute the core of my narrative. And that's what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do in words is what Devon Allen has done so magnificently in these images. And so I have to thank him precisely because it is these images that make good on the idea of the beautiful ghetto, a place of struggle, but also a place of great beauty. And with that, I will be silent and then allow my interlocutor to respond.
So I'm Devon Allen, born and raised in West Baltimore. Lived there all my life, never lived anywhere else. I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself and growing up in this beautiful ghetto. 27 years old. So growing up in Baltimore, it was tough. You know, it was very, very tough. So the thing is, me, I'm a product of my environment, but I had a strong family foundation that never let me fall too deep into, you know, that bucket of crash is what we call Baltimore. So by the time I was like 18, I was already what we call hustling. So I was on the corner a lot. I sold everything from weed to heroin to crack. And the reason why I got into that is that I didn't want to burden my mother with wanting materialistic things that I knew she couldn't get me. So I had to get it myself. Growing up, I had a lot of friends. I'm 27 now. I stopped counting about 20 how many friends have been murdered over the years. Just every year I go with losing two or three or four or five friends. You know, I remember one summer I lost like four in one summer. So grown accustomed to, and I'm very cold to. So growing up, you know, I had four best friends. They were like my brothers. So back in 2013, I lost both my brothers. We did everything together. We was inseparable. You know, we sold drugs together, party together. But when I was 19, turning 20, I found out I had a daughter on the way. So that's what kind of changed me and inspired me. What I found is with me not being around, my friends got into even more trouble because I grew up to be very calm. The older I got, controlled my temper. So back in 2013, you know, I had started my own poetry night, like 2012. So one of my friends, we went to Forest Park together. His name was Josh Austin. He went to Iraq. You know, we was like real close, but I was always the opposite. He was the, like, the angel on this side, and I was the devil on the other side. So he came to me and said, "Hey, Devin, you know a lot of people in Baltimore, because I was a party promoter. I tried everything, you know, at least once until I found myself." And he said, "Let's do a poetry night." I said, "Nobody's going to, in the hood, no one is coming to a poetry night." He was like, "Trust me, it's going to be fun." So we did it. No one came. It was like three people. So I was like, I told you, like, no, give it some time, just keep promoting. You know, and this is like when we first started getting on Twitter and Instagram, so we kept promoting, and the next week, 200 people came. We did it in Southwest Baltimore, right off of Baltimore Street, and it was amazing. So we did that for like a couple months, you know, and he came to me one day, was like, "All right, look, we making a lot of money, but you're not doing nothing." You know, I didn't do anything. I promoted, I thought my job was done. I sat at the bar, flirted with the girls, I got my drinks. He hosted the night, he said the poems, and he booked the poet. So I said, "All right, I'm gonna write a poem." So I wrote my first poem, and then growing up, everybody knew me as like this little, not a thug, but I was a little bit more hard. You know, I had a mouth full of goals, braids, you know, short tempered. So when I did my first poem, they was like, "Wow, you know, like, you're pretty good at it." But I just, you know, gained the confidence to talk to people recently, last year, after my first interview when I was stuttering on TV. But from there, you know, he said, "All right, let's like make some T-shirts or something." So we had this young lady take pictures and put them on T-shirt, but she moved too slow. So he's like, "All right, we're going to do it ourselves." He had like this little like cheap Nikon, like $200 Walmart camera. So we took the pictures and put them on a T-shirt. So then after that, we decided to take pictures at the poetry night and then put them on social media. So I went and bought like this cheap little like Fuji Coolpix camera. I can't remember what it was called. And I would take pictures at the porch at night. And then I found, you know, I was like, this is fun. This is very, you know, soothing to me. This, you know, I feel like a different person when I'm behind this camera, you know. So I just kept taking pictures of my friends. So by 2013 in January, I had been so busy with this new love of poetry and art and photography, I neglected my friends. So they were still in the streets and I wasn't, you know. So it got to the point where, you know, they would make fun of me. You know, that camera not going to get you nowhere. You need to come back out here with us. Them, you out there doing poetry, you soft, you getting soft. And I'm like, look, I'm having a ball. I'm having fun. I'm meeting new people. You know, I don't care what you say. I'm going to keep doing it. You want to make fun of my street cred? Fine, I don't care. So I just kept doing it. And then 2013, I never knew how expensive cameras was. So I was like, I want a real camera. Like, I need a real camera. I want a professional camera. So I drove to Best Buy down the street from my house. And I was like, let me get that camera. It was a Canon 60D. And let me get those two lenses. So I'm thinking, this look cool. Like, about $500, $600. When I got to the register, they was like, oh, this is $1,800. And I was like, no. You know, like I said, I was spoiled. I'm like, I'm the oldest grandson. I'm the my mother's only son. So, and I was the baby for like eight years. So I'm like baby boy. So I call my grandmother, put my sweet voice on, like, Grandma, what you doing? She's like, what you want? I know you want something. You don't call me for nothing. I was like, can I use your Best Buy credit card? I want to pick up a camera, you know? And she's like, are you going to take it serious? I was like, I don't know. I just want to, just let me use the, get it. So we went. She said, how much you going to charge? I was like, I'll let you know. I don't know. I knew. Charge anyway. So by the time she saw the bill, it was too late. I already opened it up, been shooting. So around, it's crazy that I'm here now after 2 years. I've been doing photography 3 years now. I started in 2013. That's when I got my first real camera. February, around this same time in 2013, I'm in a house editing pictures. You know, and I got a call. I had three best friends. My friend Molly, my friend Cass, and my friend Day-Day. We were inseparable. You know, and I got a call, you know, like my friend Day-Day, you know, that was like my big brother, had been shot 7 times in front of his house. So he died between his front door and his screen door. You know, and I just broke down. You know, at the same time, my other best friend, Marley, was walking through the front door. And I just remember my daughter was trying to pick me up. Like, what's wrong? You know, that's her godfather. You know, we were very close. My mother looked at all them. We were family. They were her sons also. And, you know, I just remember, you know, I hadn't spoken to him in a while because we had a real bad argument. I was like, dang, like, I can't believe he's gone. Like, that hurt so much. You know, like, a part of me left with him. And so the next day, you know, I had a photo shoot and some running around to do. I went to pay respects to his mother. And my other best friend, Casper, he was like a short, like, Muslim guy. He looked like a garden gnome, had a big beard, but very short tempered. And I would just remember him, he was, like, drunk. He had a gun on him, you know, because I hung with some serious dudes. We were really in the streets. So he had a gun on him, and I was trying to calm him down, like, yo, don't do nothing reckless, you know, like, let's figure out what's going on, let's figure out why he was murdered, who murdered him, and then we can go from there, you know. And he was just telling me the story, how when he got to the hospital, the family was in the grieving room, and he broke down, and I never seen him cry. He was, like, in and out of jail, one of the coldest dudes I ever met. He protected me, like, with his own life. Like, I done seen him run from police, fight police, like, he was a live wire. So to see him cry, you know, and they were friends way before I even came along. So I just hugged him tight and told him that I love him. Said, look, we're going to figure out what's going on. I have a photo shoot to do. I said, why don't you get yourself together? You go drop that gun off. You know, go pick up our other best friend, Molly, from in the house and meet me where I'm doing this photo shoot at. We can get some drinks and we just talk. Let's celebrate his life, you know. And he was like, all right, cool. I'm going to come. I'm not going to do nothing. Next thing I know, I get another call. You know, Chris been shot. Come to University Hospital. So when we get there, and as we walk in, another mutual friend was standing at the grieving door and was like, he was gone. So on their way back, the same guy that murdered my friend Friday shot my friend in the back of the head. And the crazy thing is, like, he hugged my friend and said, I'm sorry for what happened to Day-Day. And when he turned his back to walk up the street, he shot him in the back of the head. So I lost both my best friends in 2013 around this time. And from there, I would have been with them. I should be gone. So from there, I just dove into photography, you know, maxed out all my credit cards. It was just like a sign from the universe, from God, like, it's my time. This is for me. You know, I'm going to make this work. You know, honing my skills, finding my style, studying other photographers like Robert Houston and Gordon Parks. So when the uprising took place, I found out via text message because me and Freddie Gray had a lot of mutual friends. So when we saw the video, I was like, wow. You know, I knew what was coming. I knew because Baltimore has a certain type of mentality. It's not like any other city. You know, we are very strong-willed, you know. And the thing is, with my city, we don't fear the police at all. So it started off peaceful. You know, we had, you know, some peaceful protests. Everything was fine. You know, and the first, when I took the cover of Time, you know, like, that day was beautiful. It was 2,000 protesters from all over, you know, and we marched from Gilmore Homes to City Hall. We shut down the streets on our own with no help from the police officers. We went to City Hall. We had different speakers. The gang members united. They spoke. And then we went to confront the police officers. Everything was peaceful. Things were being thrown, but it was pretty much peaceful. Just saying, we want justice for Freddie Gray. You know, hands up, don't shoot. You know, people had on hoodies for Trayvon Martin. And, you know, I can't breathe, you know, for Aaron Garner and all these different people. And then I just remember taking pictures of the police car, and this young man sprints past me and just throws something. And I just... I'm looking, and like when I shoot, I manually focus. You know, I use like a little small, at the time we were using a small Fuji cam. I had like a 35mm lens, nothing expensive. And I just wait for him to run in the frame, and then I just snap, boom. And then I was like, this is a good picture. I didn't think nothing of it. Had Wi-Fi built into the camera, so I just, you know, all my shots are raw, I don't edit. I just send it to my phone, sent it to Twitter, you know, and I just put a little caption, you know, we're sick and tired or something like that. And I kept shooting. And then when I went home, it had all these retweets. And then from there, I just kept posting. Next thing I know, I get a call. She said, hey, this is Paul Mokin and Olivier from Time. We want to talk to you about your work. What is going on the ground? And then from there, I just kept documenting every day, and to the point where that's when I realized I was an activist. You know, when I start controlling the narrative of the story in Baltimore, and that's my story. Since then, I started my own youth program where I teach inner-city kids in the Penn North area where Freddie Gray is from. So we're documenting everyday life and not being able to drink the water because it has lead in it. That's where my journey is now.
I think that one of the things that Devin just said that is really quite extraordinary is the way in which his own life journey alerts him to the things that are happening in his community, how that becomes part of what he is doing in order to recast identity, and how it all changes as a result of this horrific violence against Freddie Gray, and the artist then becomes an activist. So I think that this is very consistent with the ideas here at the Slott Foundation to really look at the relationship between culture, art, and political activism. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, yes. Yep.
Elaborate.
You know, I just feel, definitely in my community as an artist, I feel like I have to reflect the times. You know, I felt obligated to get out there and just document. And what happens is I feel definitely in the Black community, in my community, we're not allowed to tell our own stories. Like when I research through a book, Deborah Willis has had a book about a collection of Black photographers, how, you know, our narrative was always controlled by the media and how my community is perceived to other people. You know, so I felt obligated to get out there and document and tell people the raw essence of the story because no one can tell it like I can because I'm from, you know, everything they talk about in the news, I lived it. You know, people talking about lead paint poisoning. My best friend has lead paint poisoning. You know, they want to talk about the murder rate. I've been subjected to gun violence. You want to talk about the heroin issue. You know, I sold heroin. I had heroin addicts in my family. You know, and it's just like almost any story to Baltimore I've been through. So I felt that as a resident, a concerned citizen, with a gift that I had to get out there and just document.
One of the things that impresses me a lot is the way in which you capture images and make them beautiful, because I'm sure I cannot do that. Right? And so is it something intentional? How do you select, for example, those images right there? I know that that's a whole series. Actually, what I should be asking you is to describe what the concept of the exhibit is.
Okay.
And then to tell us about those images, because those images are particularly interesting to me in that they focus on that amazing landscape, which is the human face. And so you, I think, have been very deliberate about selecting out faces without embellishment, which nonetheless are quite beautiful. So if you'd explain to us,
okay, how,
and he actually installed all that himself.
Yeah.
He's multifaceted.
Yeah, so the point of the exhibit, you know, when they came to me with the idea, I just was excited. You know, this is my first real show. I have one in Baltimore, but I didn't have complete control over it because it's through an institution, through a museum. So I couldn't give that raw energy that I wanted to. You You know, so the front room is just dedicated to everyday life in Baltimore. Those are things and places and people that Freddie Gray would have been in contact with through his community. So those images are taken up and down Gilmore Homes, Pennsylvania Avenue, you know, up and down in Sandtown area. So when you walk into that front room, I wanted to set the tone so you understand where the uprising was birthed from. You know, and then when you come into this, the next room, you see this massive collage of the chaoticness. It was just like everything was just everywhere during the uprising. So I did wheat pasting a collage, you know, just different images from the uprising. But from that, you know, you have the birth of a new activist, which are some of the fellow people that I was on the front lines with in Baltimore. You have DeRay, who's running for mayor now, who's most known for his work down in Ferguson. Me and him became very good friends through the uprising. Next to him, you have Quan Donnie, who is a spoken word artist from Baltimore, who is also a substitute teacher. Then you have Shadow, help unite the gang members on Pennsylvania Avenue and does a lot of stuff on the Penn North. Follow that, you up in the middle, I'm going to go down the middle, you have D. Watkins, who is an amazing author, has a book called The B-Side and The Cook-Up. He's from East Baltimore. He writes for the Sun, but even though he's just like an amazing author, he was not scared to come on the front lines, you know, where the police were. In the middle, you have my friend Kia, it's funny, when I saw the Freddie Gray video, you hear a young lady screaming, "His leg is broke, his leg is broke." That's her. And it's crazy because we went to high school together. She lives in Gilmore Homes. Then in the middle, you have Megan, who has her famous sign, "Stop Killer Cops." She's a silent activist. You know, she understands her role. You know, a lot of people, when it comes to Black Lives Matter or that movement, people are scared to offend people. You know, and I tell people, and I tell a lot of my white friends, like, "You're offending me by trying not to offend me. Just get out here and just work with me," you know? So she does an amazing job with that. And then I'm going back to the left. You have Nell. He has on the Nike Scully. Me and him actually work together with teaching kids photography. He's an amazing mentor. Next to him, the older man with the dreads, his name is Shorty. He's been an activist since the early, like, 95. So he's like a grandfather to all activists and inspire us and teach us how to use our voice better and, you know, elaborate on how to be an activist. And then you have in the far corner, that is Michael Wood. He was a police officer in Sandtown for about 11 years until he retired with a shoulder injury. Now he's on the opposite side of that blue shield working with us. He does a lot of work with us in the community. He comes and speaks with me and does panel discussions with me.
Michael Wood, this is your name?
Michael Wood. Then you have the young man, Kwame Rose, in the middle, the close right here on the end, closer to the end. Kwame Rose is most known for arguing with Hernando Rivera on Fox, I think that's Fox 45 on Pennsylvania Avenue, and Hernando actually tries to punch him, you know, and all he was trying to do was trying to get some answers, like, why are you here? What story are you portraying? And then below Kwame Rose is Kevin Moore, who was arrested for recording the Freddie Gray video, and he's now part of Cop Watch, does amazing work, also lives in Gilmore Homes. Back to the top is Malaika Riel. She's one of the few women activists that we had that was on the ground. She was the only person to bring our past mayor, Sheila Dixon, who is running now, and the current mayor, Rawlins Blake, together. They wouldn't take a picture. They was being real childish, but they was in the same protest together. And then underneath is a young activist. That is Michael Wood's daughter, but she's like at all the protests, Million Man March. You know, he's like really changing, you know, the mistakes that he made as a police officer, he's fixing those and teaching his daughter the right path. So with these images, there's so many more activists, but, you know, with these people I have a connection to, and I felt as I can tell their story without saying anything. You know, when I capture a person, it's so easy for me to take pictures, it's because I'm capturing what I love. You know, if I don't love something, I'm not going to take a picture of it because I don't love it. Everything that I do, my heart has to be into
it. I totally feel the love. And I have to say that Michael Wood interests me a lot. And I wish that he were here because he sounds like the kind of individual who recognizes what some of these institutional practices do to our community. I was remarking on Michael Wood because a point that is of great interest to me, two of them. One of them is the extent to which people like him actually fall and are trapped by the institutional practices. Yeah. So one of the things that I don't want, a lot is said about police brutality, but I have written a couple of columns in which, frankly, I point out what is obvious, and that is that most police officers go into service precisely because they want to serve communities, in the same way that social workers want to serve communities. And then they, too, are victims of practices that direct him to interact with people as if they were in occupied areas.
Right.
And if he were here, I'm pretty sure he would agree with that.
Yes. Michael Wood is very amazing, and he doesn't, you know, hide his mistakes from what he did as a police officer. He'll tell you some of the injustice that he has witnessed. And what happens is, like you said, they come to aid a community, but what happens is these people are not from the community. So now you have people from Pennsylvania here, you know, coming to Baltimore City, but they, when you look at, if you've never been to Baltimore City and you look at it, you do your research, all you hear is negative things. So you come in to the city thinking negative about the people in the community that you don't understand. You know, like people like Michael Wood, he was one of those people who did not understand, but it's, now he does, because he even has met people like me and people like Kwame Rose. But a lot of these police officers, they're just policing a place they don't understand. And what happens is it's all about numbers and statistics with the police. So Michael would tell you he would be policing a predominantly white neighborhood, but he got to make that quota. So where do he go? To the black community. You know, and just looking for trouble. You know, looking.
Exactly.
You know, and what happens is with my community, like the heroin right now, with heroin's been in the black community since the 60s and 70s, destroying it. You know, that didn't work, then they gave us crack. But when those drugs start to fight predominantly white communities, they get to go to California and get clean. We get locked up and come home with nothing.
So not to interrupt you in that fabulous train of thought, but let me also make this point, and that is that the so-called crack epidemic and the large amount of dangerous, inexpensive drugs, I want to make it very clear, was not the result primarily of demand in these inner city areas. It was a result of supply. And in that those were unprotected communities. And so that dealers, not the people who stand in corners, those are young people who are doing business, or as we prefer to say, business.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. And those are not the people who are actually fueling the trade. The thing is that I'm always telling my students, in places like Princeton, where I teach, you have all kinds of political protections and voices that will not allow certain cheap and dangerous drugs to... My students are all into drugs that are expensive and geeky. So at Princeton, food is to Princeton. You know, lunch is here and lunch is there, as drugs are in inner cities. And what I also object to is the idea that it's the demand, that somehow people in the community are the ones who really want those drugs. That was not at all my experience. One last thing, and I'd love your perspective on this. Several times during your lovely description of your own journey, you mentioned how you never went anywhere other than West Baltimore. And that is yet, and here I have to invoke, because I always do, one of my favorite colleagues, you'll meet him, Doug Massey, who's done such interesting work on residential segregation. And that is the fact that you don't just have material penury, but you have the state on the asses of people all the time, and then in areas in which there is no heterogeneity in terms of class, everybody is poor, or most people are poor. And this is what makes it just such a very difficult problem, because people from the outside really don't get to interact with the kinds of people that you interact with. So do you see that as a problem?
It's a very, very big problem, because I think a simple conversation, you know, can change so much. Just a simple, hello, how are you? You know, people feel, you know, that they want to, you know, weigh lives. You know, this, or you make this amount of money this year and you live here, so your life is more valued than a person who lives in a project. You know, even like me, my family came from the bottom, but my family worked hard to get where they were, so that's how I was saved. But at the same time, we still have family members that still live in the hood, that still live in the projects, that's still down. but we still love each other the same. If people could just find a way to just have a simple conversation, you know, if you're on a bus with somebody, you know, have a conversation.
Yes, exactly. Well, throughout the time that I was actually interacting with families in West Baltimore, I still have my wits or some of them. It's a miracle because I would see so much suffering and so much crisis management and so much humor and so much creativity and so much art. And then I would go to staff meetings at Johns Hopkins University in order to discuss yet another grant proposal in order to better understand poverty 15 minutes away. There was this complete disconnection. People constantly asking me, well, aren't you afraid to be in those places? In those places, people tend to be particularly mannerly, I found out, particularly young people engaged in the drug trade. Ma'am here, ma'am there. And ultimately, they often ask me, can I get a job? Where can I get a job? So there is total misunderstanding about what, and actually not to promote my book, but you know, there's a whole chapter there about how young men understand their involvement in the drug trade. If you actually suspend this belief about some kind of imputed moral imperatives and think of this as business, it turns out that's the only business in those environments. And often people operate very much in accordance with the logic of business.
I want to touch on the piece we were talking about, the drug trade. You know, and I want people to understand, like me, I was a little bit different. I had a choice. You know, it was just something that is easy money, it's quick access. But a lot of my friends who I did sell drugs with and I was in the streets with, that's all they had. One of my friends, he started selling drugs when he was 10, you know, because he wanted to help his mother. Mm-hmm. You know, she worked 2 and 3 jobs. He had a little brother and a sister, so his mother would not eat, you know, so he had to get out there and put food on the table. Those are some of the things that they faced. I had another friend of mine who he raised himself. You know, his mother was a drug addict, you know, and he turned to the drug trade to take care of himself. He was 14, 15 years old. So we're in high school, and there's a lot of my friends that make it past the eighth grade. They stopped at the eighth grade, that was it, and they turned to the streets. You know, I watched my friends. I would see them in school for the first couple months, and then they'd be gone. I'm like, where you at? He was like, I got to make some money. You know, like, I'm hungry. I need to eat. You know, I'm trying to keep the lights on. So now you have these kids not having childhoods, and they're being grown men. You know, they're carrying guns. They have no fear. You know, another friend of mine from my earlier, by the time he was 18, he killed 3 people. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Right. You want my take on that?
Yeah. It's like, you know, a lot of people, like I said, the ghetto, I call it beautiful because they think of something negative. When people think ghetto, just think about these bad people. You know, like Obama called us thugs. You know, our mayor called us thugs. You know, and it's like, a lot of these people that are not thugs, like, everyone is not good, you know, but, you know, some of these people are very genuine. If you sit down and talk to them, they're some beautiful people. They've just been dealt some bad cards.
Very bad cards.
Very, very bad.
And it was not accidental, because what you are describing is really the symptom of neglect on the part of a whole society. And one of the stories that I tell in the book, have you ever, for example, seriously asked the question, how did the Irish stop being poor? So the Irish arrived, and I've been doing a lot of reading lately about the Irish. They arrive in the United States, and you see the pictures of the time and some of the cartoons. They, too, were compared with monkeys. I have a famous cartoon in which the Irish were represented as darker-skinned people who look very much like monkeys. How did that stop? Well, many people in the United States would imagine that that stopped as a result of excellent values and hard work. But when you look at the record, it was also through government intervention in the right way, by giving people incentives in the accumulation of property and education. African Americans did not get that kind of legislation. And, you know, I don't have a lot of time here, nor do I want to monopolize the conversation. But the point is that when you're talking about bad cards, that is a fact. That is a historical fact. So what interests me in part, well, the lack of investment in African-American people offends me. But what interests me is how creative those communities are in the way that you have described in your own art.
Even in my career, you know, it's certain things that I don't get because I'm black. You know, you know, sponsorships I can't get, you know, struggling trying to get, you know, stuff off the ground with my youth program, you know, and even when reaching out to some people for sponsorships with cameras, you know, and my work is very, they consider my work negative. My work is negative. That's one of the reps from Fuji told me. I called them out on Twitter. You know, they try to email, we want to send you some cameras. Yeah. And I was like, no, I'm not, you know, I want people to understand, like, I'm an activist. You know, I'm not rich. I'm not trying to get rich. You know, I'm here for social change and to uplift my people. So you can, if I feel you don't really want to help, I don't want your help. You know, I will struggle. I struggle all my life. I will find a way. So even with them, that kind of hurt. You know, like, everyone tells me I have amazing work, you know, and it feels good. I was in a festival. So, you know, I went with Instagram and they said, go talk to them. I'm sure you'll get it. You know, even Tom said, you're going to get it. You know, the rep told me, oh yeah, we saw the Time cover. You know, it was negative. We didn't want our brand to promote that. So after that, I was kind of discouraged. Like, wow, you know, like, is my work negative? I kind of second guessed myself. Like, maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way. The picture, or I don't know. I went back and talked to some other photographers, some guys from like Washington Post, a couple guys from New York Times, Rolling Stone, and a couple guys from the Magnum. And I just told them, and they was like, did you forget your black? Look at this. And they sent me all this work from other photographers, you know, predominantly white, that were taking stuff of the conflicts in Africa and stuff going on in Afghanistan. But, you know, they get the new camera equipment. When new cameras out, they get it. You know, I don't get that.
That,
you know,
will change, I'm sure.
Yeah, Samsung reached out to me and lent a little bit of help, but I still don't have, like, that concrete contract of sponsorship.
But you know what I think is just awesome is the way in which you are using social media and advanced technology in order to both disseminate your art and actually respond to attempts to erase you. I think that is really very interesting. And it's part of the new activism, which it does not depend only on demonstrations or strikes. We don't have strikes anymore.
Right.
But
yeah,
it depends on this kind of voice.
Yeah, there's so many ways. Like I tell people, this is a war. You know, not just police brutality, but just, you know, the typical good versus evil. You know, you don't have to be on the front lines to be an activist. There's little things you can do in your everyday life to make change. You know, just, you know, say hello, have a conversation, you know, or if you can't be there, you know, donate $20 to something. There's so many ways that you can help, but it starts with you. You know, if you can't be, like I tell people, oh, what can I do to help? You know, it starts with you. There's so many different ways that you can go about this. You know, for me, my gift is photography. Some people are good at storytelling verbally. Do that. You know, some people are just good at connecting dots and connecting people. You do that. You know, whatever your niche is, if you could just lend that niche, you know, not just to, you know, to Black Lives Matter or anything else, and I won't get confused. Like, I love Black Lives Matter, but I love the movement, but I'm not a part of it because I believe Black Lives Matter, you have to die and you need media attention. I had a friend of mine that was shot in the face in Baltimore last year. He survived. He's fine. He's home now. But the media didn't perceive it. Why? Because he had a little record. You know, he'd been in some trouble, but he wasn't, you know, They didn't, oh no, we got to march for Corey. And no, that didn't happen because you have to die or you have to bring this certain type of media connection. You know, even now people are struggling with, you know, transgender lives and this thing. And, you know, and it just bothers me.
Which kind of brings me back to Freddie Gray, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Because what was particularly outrageous about that event is that this is a 25-year-old young man. He is not a menace to society. He is basically a marginal figure in the drug trade whose mother had a drug habit, kind of a familiar circumstance,
yes,
and who had probably been affected by lead poisoning as he grew up in these neglected,
yes,
areas. And the on the day that he was arrested, he wasn't doing anything particular. He was just kind of like looking dangerous.
Yeah.
And then how exactly can a body be treated in such a way that on the way to a station, his spine is almost severed? It's still a mystery to me, to be perfectly honest. I just don't get it. And how do we produce individuals inserted in these institutions who actually can allow the, they must have been hearing the body handcuffed and moving around in the back of that vehicle, and there was no intervention. Okay. So this kind of dehumanization can only come from this separation. You are you, we are not part of you.
Right. Yeah, and the thing is, like, they kept saying they took him on a rough ride. I've been on a rough ride before. It's bad, trust me. They tie the cuffs so tight you lose the feeling in your hands. And they don't use metal cuffs anymore because they only can get them so tight. So they use the plexi ones. They can pull them real tight. You know, like when I had mines on, you know, I was locked up. I got arrested back in 2009, and the police actually put drugs on me. I was driving a fairly, my mother had a, I just was in a car accident. I started a new job. It was Friday. We was going to celebrate, go get some drinks. My best friend was still alive at the time. We was on our way, and they pulled us over. You know, I had my mother had the brand new Camry. I was like 2009 Camry. You know, we was blasting. We was, you know, we was young. You know, and they pulled us over. And they said this car was reported stolen or is whatever. And I said this can't be. Here's the registration. My mother's last name is Allen. Here's my license. My name is Devin Allen. You know, at the time, you know, I was young. I was scared. You know, get out the car. So I had to get out the car. They frisked us, didn't find anything. So they sat us on the curb for a while. And I said, you gonna let us go? You didn't find nothing. Everything is fine. I don't have any tickets, no warrants. Can we go? No, wait. They come back and some more police officers come. So at this point, it's like 10 police officers out there. And they call the paddy wagon up and they search the car again. And then they find some weed. Where did this come from? I was like, I don't know. I don't smoke weed. My mother don't smoke weed. I don't know where you got that from. And they put it on us. So they put us in the paddy wagon and where the rough ride is. We got locked up at 7 p.m. We didn't get down to be processed till 1 in the morning. And it's summertime. And it's a van, but then it's split down the middle. So women go on one side and the men go on the other. So then they drove around Baltimore City for hours picking up anybody else, doing house raids, picking people up. So now it's to the point it's like 10 people packed, me sitting on top of each other. By the time I got to be processed, I couldn't even feel my fingers. My hands were blue. And then I ended up sitting there. You know, they frisked you. They take your shoestrings, take everything. And then I went to court. They didn't have a drug analysis, so it got thrown out. But, you know, what happened to Freddie Gray, you don't get that on a rough ride.
I get
at
it.
All. You know, they made a stop. They beat him. You know, yeah. How many times did they stomp him? And then still after they stomped him and severed his spine, I remember then they threw him back into the van.
I just don't get it. The other thing I don't get is how these narratives are produced, then put before the American public, and it's like, oh, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Because it don't make any sense to me.
You got, like, Michael Wood made some. He said police are here to protect the Constitution. But half of them, if you tell them to say it or say anything from it, they don't know. He's like, a lot of the cops are idiots, you know. They're complete idiots, you know, and that's the sad part about it. They get out here, and the thing is, like I try to tell people, they say it's a black and a white thing when it comes to the police. No, it's a blue thing. They love that shield. They protect each other regardless.
Yeah, so just in defense, and I don't boo me, but in defense of the cops, I will say that it's hard to be a police officer.
Yeah.
Because when you have certain guidelines that allow you to have that kind of power over the other people and dehumanize them, then you go with the herd.
So
I'm not really making excuses for them. I'm just saying that what we need are better practices and better guidelines for people to observe.
Like me, you know, like I said, I just fight evil. Like I just, you know, color, race is, you know, I just hate evil in general. And I want people to understand, like, even with, like, police officers, I mean, these are people, you know, and then they get paid next to nothing to risk their life to come out every day to protect people that they're already scared of because of what they see on TV. You know, and what needs to happen is better training, psych evaluations daily. They need to be taught to. This person comes to work, it's a 9-to-5. You can't treat it like that. You have so many lives in your hand. You know, just imagine this. Let's say this police officer knew Freddie Gray. Because he's in the community so much, he has a connection with the community because he's there every day.
Yep.
Some of these police officers are moved around.
Exactly.
So one day he might be in a pretty neighborhood, the beautiful part of Baltimore City. Then you move him to Greenmount, East Baltimore, but now they're back to West Baltimore. What if you had 10 to 15 police officers that stayed in the same community every day? So now you know Freddie. You know Freddie sells drugs, but he's not a bad guy.
Yeah.
So now, instead of going that far, you have a connection. What needs to happen is they need to be forced to walk the beat. There's no reason why I can walk down the street and I'm documenting the city and I can sit there and take 4 or 5 pictures of police officers because he in the car taking selfies on Instagram. He's not doing his job. And that's what they do. They really be, they don't do their job. They're just a 9 to 5. They come, drive all the way to Baltimore, 2 hours, go police, come back home.
Yeah.
You know, and like Michael Wood will tell you, he lives in York, PA, around a lot of Baltimore City police officers. A lot of them have Confederate flags in their yard. And Michael Wood will tell you that himself.
So here's the other thing. When I talk about the omnipresent state, I mean, all these institutions are there, so that from the time of birth, a child, I tell this because it was deeply traumatic to me when I first noticed that when a child is born in poverty in those neighborhoods, it's a very, very good chance that a social worker is going to be first to see you, not your mother. And that starts this kind of sequence in which by the age of 9, you have been medicated with something, diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, and are beginning to be seen as a menace. And so there's kind of what boring sociologists call path dependence. You're already on this kind of assembly line, which is a kind of making it very difficult for you not to be punished for even the tiniest infractions. What I'm pointing to this here, what I'm trying to point to, is that there's a whole industry here. It's not just the carceral industry, it's not just prisons, but it's all this apparatus of control where people actually derived a lot of benefits from advising, from designing programs, for providing the subcontracted detention services, all that you have described. And I find that, again, extremely scary.
It's very, it's another thing, like with lead paint, you know, and a lot of issues, like I learned firsthand from a lot of my friends have lead paint poison. What happens is, you know, they never get help. What happens is they give them a lump sum of money and say, all right, well, you have high levels of lead, so you probably have a bad temper, ADHD, and all these other issues. So what we're going to do is when you turn 21, we're going to give you how much money you would have made if you didn't have lead paint. So you talking about guys in the inner city, never had nothing, walking away with $100,000. You know, I've known guys in the hood that got $1 million in lead paint reimbursement.
They didn't even have to kill anyone.
They didn't have to kill anyone. They had lead paint. They now they got all this money. And what happens is they don't know what to do with it. And those guys become some of the biggest drug dealers in the city. You know, and it's like, but they never got help. You know, they just like, oh, we don't have time to help. We just take this lump sum of money.
So what I'm going to say, and this is an opportunity for you to intervene. Otherwise, I'm going to bring it to a close and maybe we can mingle informally, as I don't see any hands here, is that what we really, I mean, I think that you're doing a fantastic job with your art. This illustrates something that I call expressive entrepreneurship. The society is not providing a lot of employment opportunities to people in West Baltimore, but at least from what we can see, a lot of people in West Baltimore are responding in ways that are artistic and creative of beauty. Yes? What I think we have to fight is not just the piecemeal opposition to, say, police brutality, which is a reality, but a larger fight against these institutions which are constantly separating us from impoverished people, particularly African Americans. And so the fight is to make the beautiful ghetto visible.
Yes.
To the larger society and to salvage its meaning. Yes?
Yes.
And so as this is a man who is going to become the greatest photographer of his generation, I think he will.
You know, I think people want to get into office to try to change these things, but then they have all these other different levels above them to tell them what to do. So do we have to gut, like, well, bottom line, I think everything needs to be gutted out for any type of change, or we want to keep putting people over this broken foundation, and then nothing is going to change. But everything needs to be gutted out. I don't think anyone's coming, anyone in this mayor race, I don't even think they're going to fix anything. Like, I think Baltimore is like, we need to basically, like I said, gut everything and then start from square one. And if we can't do that, you know, things might seem good on the outside, but internally it's still going to be messed up.
The story of West Baltimore is really the story of all inner cities throughout the United States. It's Ferguson, it's Philadelphia, it's South Central, it's Trenton. And this issue about color or race, I mean, it's a long story, but to be part of a group defined in terms of race or ethnicity does not guarantee solidarity, au contraire. As a matter of fact, a lot of the people who hold the greatest interest in controlling poor people are people who feel that those people are giving them a bad name. Does the name Pit Bull mean anything to you? Great rap singer, multimillionaire, right out of Hialeah, which is not exactly a ghetto, but this is a Cuban working class rap singer who captures a lot of the animosity that working class Cubans have towards educated Cubans who heavily discriminate against them. So the emphasis, I think, is not on whether there's a black mayor here or a black mayor there. The emphasis is, and I think you said it beautifully, upon that system of control that has to be rethought. And I know that's a big point in the agenda. But on the other hand, we haven't been talking about that. We don't speak about race and poverty in terms of the institutions that maintain poverty and racial discrimination. So when you say we have to gut it all up, I think you're right. I think that's where we have to direct our attention, not to the color of the mayors, but to the practices of the institutions.
Yeah, I watched a documentary about, it's called The Square, about Egypt and the activism done there. And even when you look at Ukraine and the activism they did there, how they really put pressure on, you know, the president or their leaders. And that's what we have to do. We have to, you know, start holding our leaders accountable for the stuff they say they're going to do. You know, we sit there and say, oh, we're not going to vote for you. You know, that's not going to cut it. We have to really put that pressure on, you know, to make these people like, look, you know, you need to give up this chair. You know, and that's what Egypt did so well, and that's what Ukraine did so well when they pushed their president out.
So I want to thank you. I learned a lot. I'm so pleased to think of you as a new friend. And thank you all for being here. And I don't know whether there is a little time for informal interaction. But thank you for coming to this exhibit.